The last 3 weeks, I was sort of rushing through preliminary stuff that is probably known from some signal processing class or some image processing class. And the next 3 weeks, we will talk about geometry. And I think this geometric stuff is where computer vision actually has a really a strong point. It's very rigorous. And we're getting to that. And it will be a little bit slower because I'm sort of making this assumption that the content is mostly new to you. Not necessarily if you attended Mark Stamminger's computer graphics. So then there's still some overlap. Okay, I cannot avoid this. But other than that, yeah. So we start today with talking about cameras and optics. So the pinhole camera model, perspective projection, and then like the intrinsic and extrinsic camera parameters. Okay, let me remove this. So what is a camera? Okay, so the direct translation is room. And the reason for this is that like very early observations were made with a little inner room with a little hole in the wall. And then the observation was that the picture reversed appeared on the wall of that room in a dark chamber. Okay, this is probably known from physics, but nevertheless, let's dwell a little bit on these historic examples. So there were always applications for optical apparatus like this, for example, in order to support the drawing of a specific scene, yeah, to build a construction that projects the scene onto a flat area such that it can be drawn. And here's an interesting reference to a movie. It's Tim's Vermeer. And the idea by Tim was that actually Vermeer had some support of some optical device, yeah, but it wasn't really clear what this optical device was, but had some support by an optical device in order to draw his scenes, yeah, and so the artist here in this movie, he made a couple of experiments what this optical device was that Vermeer used for drawing his scenes. And it quickly turned out it can't have been like a simple mechanism to create these projections because then the colors in the image wouldn't be right. Yeah, so then he kept experimenting with different setups and discovered a lot of actually optical artifacts in Vermeer's pictures that might be due to his like tool that helped him to depict the scene on a plane, like chromatic aberration, for example, that gave him some indications what this tool might have been about. So these are all precursors to the actual cameras that we used. And then thereafter, like photography has been developed. Yeah? Okay, so generally speaking, when we have such an imaging process, we have a reduction of a 3D scene onto a 2D image, and this is typically done via perspective projection. So there are a lot of optical tricks that can be done with this dimensionality reduction because it's certainly not perfect. Here's a famous photograph of a lake. It looks as if this all like this is a very bizarre structure. It is a very bizarre structure, but captured from a different direction, it already makes a lot more sense. So it's just like a normal lake, and then it it flows into the sea. Okay. Yeah, here's another optical trick. So there's a lot of trickery that can be done when looking at 2D projections of images. Like here, it looks as if two kids are on top of this sphere, but like if we step a little bit on the side, we see, okay, it's just like some installation here on this square to create this illusion. Okay, and here's finally, I think, the last example. It's in an old painting, like normal picture, but then there's this distorted structure here. And when you actually stand here below the picture, you can see, oh, it's, what is it? It's a skull, yeah? Okay, So the old artists, they have been looking into these optics and optical tricks for quite a while, and they built devices, like essentially cameras, camera types, lens type devices for a long time, and played with that. So what we are talking about is essentially old physics, yeah? And you certainly also remember a couple of things from your physics classes in the past. Okay, now, if we think about computer vision, I mean, what are our vision tasks? Yeah, it's not playing around with some piece of art or so, but actually it's typically some type of measurement task that we should address. Like, for example, answer questions like, how tall is this woman? Like in the real, like what is the real height of this woman? Or at what, like how high is the camera above the ground? Could be that the camera is actually mounted on a quadrocopter and we're doing navigation, like we do an image guided navigation support for that quadrocopter. Or a similar question, what is the camera rotation with respect to the world? Or again, referring to the scene, which of these balls is closest? Yeah, for us humans, it's fairly easy to say, okay, we have a ground plane, so then this ball must be closest. But if you think of simpler strategies, but just like going by the size of the ball, then it's certainly deceiving that we have a very little ball here and a larger ball there, for example. Yeah? Okay. And here's an example application that has been published or presented 2006 on SIGGRAPH. And it's actually on the cover of this book accompanying this lecture. Let me show you the video. You can find the video on YouTube. It's one of these typical videos accompanying a submission to one of the highly competitive conferences like SIGGRAPH. It's probably the... Can you hear this? I guess there's no way for you to hear this, what the guy is saying. But... So what they are saying is, essentially, they are proposing a method to align a whole lot of images that have been grabbed from the internet or from some collection, like photo collection, to align a whole lot of images based on the image content. Like for here, for example, the Trevi Fountain in Rome. and then to play with the possibilities that this mutual alignment provides. So what possibilities do we have Here they called it phototourism. So they say like, yeah, okay, I can move from camera to camera. We know this nowadays, I think pretty well from if we think of the Google Street View. Yeah, but like 12 years ago or so, this was like, wow, a cool new thing. No? And it was not yet the case that this was in products. Now, when they are flipping between pictures here, we see already we get maybe already a sense of the challenges that have to be overcome when working with pictures from different cameras. Because it turns out, like if we have 10 pictures from 10 people, all taken for the Trevi Fountain, it turns out if we overlay them, that they are all a little bit different. Like each picture is a little bit different from the other picture. This may be either due to different pose or different lighting, or we could, or maybe both pictures, actually both photographers were at exactly the same locations and still the pictures don't match because the cameras created slightly different pictures. So it turns out they are distorted to each other. And these are the properties that we are going to talk about. And this all has to be normalized in order to align these pictures together. Okay, this goes on and on. They're just like, it's the same idea as with the Trevi Fountain, but just shown on different data sets, say. Okay. Yeah, so exploring photo collections in 3D. That was the pitch line there. But you could also think, I mean, if you have this alignment of multiple cameras, I think an application that you could also think of, I already mentioned this last week, is this Building Rome in a Day. Building Rome in a Day was, I think, 2008 or so, like maybe 2 years later, that you use this alignment to reconstruct the object that you're looking at in 3D. Okay. So what are the key components of a camera? Certainly, we have a sensor, but the sensor alone won't do it because then reflections from specific points in the scene will fall at every location of the sensor. And the fix to this actually, and that is the trick of the pinhole camera, is to block almost all of these rays and only let them pass at a small location. Yeah. Such that each point, like if this is infinitesimally small, then a point here gets imaged at or projected onto exactly one point there. Yeah? And if we make this slit wider, then we observe some blurring that multiple rays hit onto an area here on the sensor plane. Yeah? Okay. But the problem is our sensor needs a certain amount of light. So we cannot make the slit arbitrarily small because then no light gets through anymore. Okay, and the trick or the compromise actually is to make the slit a little bit wider and put a lens in that performs, like bundles the rays that come from one direction and project it still on a single point on the sensor plane. Yeah, that's the whole trick. That's the whole trick of the cameras. Okay. And then, so a term that is always used is the pinhole camera model. So, I think we've seen already how it works. We have the object, we have this pinhole. Let's not discuss lenses at this point. We have the image plane, the sensor plane, and then there's another notion that is the focal length. So this is the distance between the image plane and the pinhole. And there's the optical center of the camera. So this is where all the rays meet and then diverge again. Ah, sorry, here's the focal length is here. Okay, yeah. Good. Now, our goal is to calculate with the geometry, perform calculations with the geometry. So if we talk about a point in the world, in the 3D world, it's a three-dimensional, it's a three-component vector, P, X, Y, Z. And if we talk about the projection on the image plane, it's a two-dimensional vector, here U and V. Yeah? And so U is the horizontal offset, for example, and V the vertical offset, all with respect to the image center U0, V0. Okay, so here's the camera center. And here is our actual object. C is the distance, is the depth, like the distance of the object to the camera center. Good. Now, we can calculate the coordinate u as essentially x times focal length f over z. So this is an application of, oh wow, it's the English word for Strahlensatz. Ah, that's bad. If you have an idea, tell me. Okay, there's a theorem relating linearly relating the lengths either on one side of an intersection of lines or on two sides of the intersection of lines. It's impossible. What was the intersect theorem? Okay, intersect.
No, intercept.
Sorry. Intercept theorem. Yeah, sorry, I did not prepare for this. All right. Okay, thank you. All right, so with this intercept theorem, I think it's fairly straightforward. So we have F, we have Z, we have the, okay, for we see it better for Y and V, sorry. We have the Y offset, and this gives us V, okay. And here we have a change of signs because that is just the way how we defined our coordinate system here. Okay. Okay, and what is the effect if F and Z are equal? Well, then, so this can be omitted and we just have U equals minus X or V equals minus Y. Okay. So, when we think about quantities that are invariant or that are not invariant to projection, yeah, then we can enumerate a couple of things. So if we perform a projection on a 2D plane, then lengths are lost. So we cannot, if we do a comparison, who is taller, this person or that person, we cannot do a naive comparison by measuring this in the image. Yeah, but because depth comes in. Yeah, so people that are further away are smaller in their projection. Yeah, and if lengths are lost, then area is lost. Okay. So the closer object appears larger than the object that is further away. This is this also has this has a number of practical implications. Maybe most day-to-day type of application is that if you take a picture of yourself or so, like make a selfie, and the camera is just in front of your nose, then your nose looks huge. So if this is you, no, and your nose looks like this, then you took a selfie from a very close distance. No? And this is called foreshortening. Yeah. Or this effect is due to foreshortening, and foreshortening, again, is sort of a variation of this effect. Yeah? Okay, good. Next thing, what about angles? Angles are also lost. Yeah. So for example, in the real world, we have here two parallel lines. Yeah. If we connect these lines in the 2D projection, they are not parallel anymore. Yeah, so this angular relationship is gone. Okay, so we can spin up this argument for parallel lines. Same pain with perpendicular lines. So all these relationships cannot be measured from 2D images. Okay. Yeah, then the converse question is like, what is preserved? So, so interestingly, what is preserved is that straight lines remain straight. Yeah, this may sound trivial at first glance, but this is actually the property that we can count on. Okay, and then, yeah, what happens is we said angles change. So what happens to these parallel lines if they are projected onto the image? So what we know is that parallel lines intersect at a so-called vanishing point. So a vanishing point is where parallel lines meet. And these vanishing points are not necessarily in the scene, like here for the ray tracks, they are, so no problem. But it turns out if we have a 3D projection, if we have a projection of a 3D world onto a 2D plane, then we have three vanishing points in the scene. Yeah? And we could see those three if we had more parallel lines. We will look at such a case in a second. And then some of these vanishing points are virtually always outside of the scene. Okay. And yeah, another remark. So if we have parallel lines on the same plane in the world, then all these lines, so all the vanishing points of all these pairs of lines line up to a vanishing line. Yeah, and this is what typically we would call the horizon. Okay, yeah, so here's a case, a typical case for a man-made scene. Yeah, when we look at buildings, we have perpendicular angles everywhere. And then if we start to connect these lines in horizontal and vertical direction, then we see the three vanishing points. So one to this side, one to the other side and one up there. And in this case, they are all outside of the scene. Yeah, so they are not necessarily in the scene. Yeah, and these are also geometric invariants that we can exploit in our projective geometry. Okay. Now our task is, or like the typical task in computer vision is that we have an object in world coordinates, here denoted with a capital X, and we would like to mathematically express and then calculate with the corresponding 2D projection of this object in the scene. Yeah, so this is a lowercase x. Yeah, and it almost always ends up with pictures of this type. Yeah, so we have an origin of our coordinate system. We have an object coordinate system O in the world. Well, these are the world coordinates, but typically the object is in these world coordinates. And then we are looking at some projection. So this is the pi onto the sensor. Yeah, and mathematically, like three components are involved, or typically we model this using three components. One is a matrix of intrinsic camera parameters. So this is what happens inside of the camera on the sensor, essentially. So the interplay of sensor and lens. And then there are the extrinsic parameters, which are typically split into rotation and translation. What means extrinsic parameters? This is the pose of the object in the scene. So we have the pose of the object. It's somehow, it's not the pose of the object, but it's the relationship of the camera to the object. So relationship of camera to the object, and then intrinsic parameters, the relationship of the optical elements to each other inside of the camera. Okay, and this is just like a matrix vector multiplication. So we have here a vector matrix. This is a matrix, and this is also a vector, although it's in uppercase letters, but it's a computer vision convention that they like to also use sometimes uppercase letters for vectors. Okay. Now here's a really nice web page that explains the intrinsic and extrinsic camera parameters in a matrix. So you can please feel invited to have a look at this, particularly when you're learning this material. It's a really nice source, actually. Okay. Now, there's one particularity that you probably saw or heard about when you heard the computer graphics class, and that is that it is really recommended to calculate in projective or like homogeneous coordinates. Yeah, the normal representation of a 2D point is, well, two coordinates, x and y. And in these projective coordinates, we have a third parameter, which is the w. And it denotes, yeah, essentially, you can consider it as the distance to the object. So the depth. But the problem is that we cannot really you cannot really observe the depth in a 2D projection. Yeah? So this is an ambiguity that we have. Okay. And it's oftentimes referred to as a scaling parameter, no? Because if we select W being longer or shorter, then in principle we would expect our object to scale with W. Okay, but the general way to think about this is that instead of having a point XY in an image, it's like a ray that extends along, well, the projection of our camera. Okay. Now, the same thing can be done in 3D. Then XYZ are extended to XYZ W. And other than that, everything else remains the same. So objects that are far away appear smaller. Good. So, yeah, I already mentioned homogeneous coordinates. So that's the like typical way to approach this. So we can, instead of dealing with X and Y in Cartesian coordinates, we can extend this vector by one element. Let's say we extend a one. We will see in a second that this is arbitrary in principle. And then we have homogeneous coordinates. Yeah? Same thing with the 3D vector. We extend it by an entry one, and then we have 3D homogeneous coordinates. And if we would like to go back to our Cartesian coordinates, the convention is to divide by the last entry. Yeah? So that means if we just extend by one, if we would like to convert it back, we divide by one and nothing changes. Yeah? But if we think of this factor in a more general sense, so if it's some distance parameter W, then we would divide by this, and this would yield as the Cartesian coordinates by convention for 2D and 3D. Okay, so what is the purpose of all this? It sort of implicitly clarifies that, or it implicitly brings some scale invariance into the projection space. So in the homogeneous coordinates, if we have a vector, we multiply it by k and convert it back to Cartesian coordinates, then we see that the k is cancels out, and we just have the same result as if we would not have multiplied it by k. So yeah, so the key term for this is that we are always dealing in these projections with a scale ambiguity. And this is an important concept if we think of measurement tasks, for example. Yeah. So we oftentimes have the problem, we estimate, for example, we have multiple cameras, like in the phototourism application. Yeah, we have multiple cameras. We align them to each other so we know how all these cameras are located to each other. But then still, oftentimes, if we don't have some reference object in the scene, we have everything figured out up until scale, because the scale is the last item that we can't know. So how is this? Let me very quickly jump. So if we don't have, so this is again the Trevi fountain, sorry, from the phototourism video. These are all the camera positions estimated nicely to each other. Yeah. But unless we have some reference object in here or some notion about some one single distance, yeah, we need one single distance. If we don't have this, then we don't know whether the Trevi fountain is actually just like a little toy or something, yeah, and we have very tiny cameras placed around it, or whether it is actually like a real monument, no, like a life size of fountain. Yeah? So this is the scale ambiguity, and in many vision applications, we have this task of, okay, we just define something. Yeah, so we define this to be in some unit scale. No? So we say, oh, these are meters or so, and work from that. Or, of course, we have calibrated cameras, and then part of the calibration is to also solve the question of scale. Yeah. Okay, but in the case of the phototourism, if they are just downloading pictures from the internet, there's no calibrate, like they cannot calibrate these cameras from the downloaded images. Okay. Good, yeah, so there are a couple of rules for calculating inhomogeneous coordinates, and it's certainly best if you have a look at the respective section in the book. It's section 2.1 in the book to look up these calculation rules. But essentially, a line can be represented by a line equation. We have this transformation to homogeneous coordinates by appending a one. I already talked about this. We can create a line from two points by computing the cross product of these points. And we can intersect two lines and obtain a point by computing the cross product of the lines. So all these types of calculations are quite convenient. And okay, another problem that we can solve in homogeneous coordinates is that we intersect parallel lines without having to deal with infinite coordinates as we would have in the Cartesian coordinates. Okay, I'm just jumping quickly over this. Okay, so now let's have a look. Sorry, now let's have a look at these at the projection from a world point onto the image plane a little bit more closely. So, so here's a quite simple approach, let's say. So we have our homogeneous coordinates of a 3D point XYZ. We project it onto a 2D point UV by using as an intrinsic matrix only a diagonal matrix that uses twice the focal length and a one. Yeah? This makes sense if we make a number of assumptions that essentially come from simply drawing this or simply reading it from this figure. So up until now, what we've said is we have a point X, we have this intercept theorem. So what we need to know is the focal length. We have our x here, and then we use the intercept theorem to solve for u and v. Yeah? Okay, what we're implicitly assuming here is that we have a unit aspect ratio. So this means in x and y direction, we have the same step size, for example, the same pixel size. Yeah. Our optical center is located at 0, 0. And we have no skew of the whole system, so it's not squished in a way. The object is not rotated, and yeah, the camera is at 0, 0, 0. Okay. So if all these assumptions hold, then the projection is fairly straightforward. And the interesting thing is now, and if you would like to start somewhere, we can make all these assumptions and make the estimates. However, it turns out that actual imaging systems oftentimes deviate from these assumptions. And then depending on the level of complexity that you can afford or that you have to address for your application, you can step by step drop these assumptions. Yeah? And it turns out the more assumptions we drop, the more variables we will have to estimate in our matrices in order to describe this mapping between world coordinates and image coordinates. Okay. So so let's say we don't know where the optical center is. Because of some manufacturing particularity, the optical center is not at 0, 0, yeah, but it's maybe a little bit shifted. So this shift can be modeled by introducing two new unknowns here, U0 and V0. This is a translation here in the intrinsic camera matrix K. Everything else remains the same. So we still assume unit aspect ratio. We still have only our focal length here. And we have no extrinsic like rotation of the object. Okay. The next thing is the equal aspect ratio. So what if our focal length is not identical in x and y direction? Then we just convert this one unknown that we had into two unknowns, sorry, x and y. And eventually, if we admit a skew of the image plane, then we obtain another unknown here. We had a 0 here before. We can mathematically express q as another unknown here. And this is the form of the intrinsic camera parameters that we are, in the most general case, dealing with. Okay, now the extrinsic parameters. It may happen, of course, that our object is a little bit rotated or translated with respect to the camera, or the camera is a little bit rotated and translated. And in order to find out or to model this relationship, now we have the intrinsic parameters here, the extrinsic parameters here. Translation are three entries here at the right half of the matrix. Yeah? This is camera translation. You can have situations of just translation. So in which cases might you have just translation and no rotation? Doesn't this sound a little bit unrealistic? Stereo cameras. Ah, yeah, that's a good example. Yeah, although they are also oftentimes then rotated a little bit to each other. But yes, you could, if you had an ideal stereo system, then you have just translation. And you make it simple, you just have translation. Yeah, okay. Another situation where we might end up with just translation. I think it makes a lot of a lot of sense to consider all types of industrial applications. No? There's a whole pile of money that can be made when you do industrial vision systems. No? It's maybe not as exciting as phototourism or so, but then when you think of a robot or something moving along a rail or so, then you have a very defined translational motion, no? But you have no rotation, something like this. Okay. Yeah, and then of course rotation, when rotation comes in, then you can quickly fill up the rest of the matrix. So rotation by the x-axis, y-axis, z-axis is always expressed with the, like, certainly known to you already, like cosine and sine type of manipulation of the involved dimensions, and just a single 1, 0, 0 of the dimension that stays fixed. And you can combine these together to have a full, like a free rotation in space. Okay. Now, so if you also allow camera rotation, then we end up with all these unknowns here. And these are, if we counted how many parameters we have to estimate the full system, we have 5 unknowns here. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So this was the focal length in x and y direction, or the scale in x and y direction. This was for shear. We have some shear in our projection, and this is for the position of the optical center. Yeah. So these are 5, the intrinsic parameters. Now the extrinsic parameters. This looks like a whole lot more than 6, right? But it turns out that not all of these, like, okay, these are 12. Okay, no, no question about it. But it turns out that not all of these 12 entries are independent. No? So we only have 6 independent parameters actually here. Okay. Yeah, again, so there's this nice web page to look at, and this explains it a little bit more. And of course, the book. No? Good. Now, now there are some notable special cases, yeah, that are not so some special cases. So maybe best known is the orthographic projection. It means essentially, okay, we're just chopping off one coordinate or a coordinate of a rotated version of the object. But let's say we're just chopping off one coordinate, yeah, and this projection is expressed by such a matrix. So essentially removing one coordinate is expressed by having here a column of zeros, and that's it. So we are essentially taking out Z and end up with a direct representation of X and Y. And there's a slight variant to this. It's called scaled orthographic projection. It's also rarely used, but consider a situation where you have very distant objects, like where your beamline, for example, if you work in X-ray stuff or so, or in physical experiments, or if you work in normal optics, like where you have a very long distance between your camera and the actual object, and then the variations in the object itself are comparably flat. Yeah, then you could say, okay, for mathematical reasons, it's much more convenient to me to model this as an orthographic projection where I have then a small estimation error, yeah, because it's of course still a perspective projection, but the relationship between the distances is so that the orthographic projection comes close enough. Yeah, for example, I'm working together with Gisela Anton at the physics lab, so, and they built so-called X-ray phase contrast interferometers. So that means you have an X-ray tube. X-ray tube is like a light source, just in a different wavelength. You have an X-ray tube, and then you illuminate an array of gratings. Gratings in German is Gitter. So a grating, here's another grating, and this sort of, so this ends up being an interferometer. Let's not go into the physical details here, yeah? Okay, but the thing is, so the distances that we are talking here are maybe 2 meters, and the distance between the grating bars is maybe in the range of 2 micrometers. Yeah, so there's a factor of 1 million between those two, and then we say, oh, okay, you know, like that's like the difference between this ray passing through this slit and that ray passing through the next slit is so little. No, I mean, we can compute it. Yeah, there's some angle alpha and so on and so on. But if you compute it, it turns out it's almost the same. No? And then we can say, okay, so this is like an orthographic projection. No? So this is a typical case to make this type of approximation. Okay, for the weak perspective, so we had the true orthographic projection. Here the scaled orthographic projection essentially just says, okay, we also chop off Z, and we have a small scaling parameter then to scale the image as a whole, but in its orthographic projection. Okay. So here's another thing, just to develop a little bit more of a feeling for these optical quantities. If we think of optical zoom, yeah, so an optical zoom device is essentially one that increases the focal length, yeah, and if we think of our intercept theorem, sorry, I have to learn this word. So the intercept theorem states, so we have our focal length here. Here's our optical center. And then we have some distance to the object. And if we would like to image a structure, in the world at a specific distance C, then we can scale this structure on the image plane when we make the focal length F larger or smaller. I think this intuitively makes sense, right? So if we make F smaller, so let's make F prime only so short, no? Then we have a situation where these 2 points map onto almost the same point here on the image plane. Yeah? If we make F larger, then actually the distance here between these 2 points increases. Yeah? And that's like the way how to build a zoom lens. Okay, and there are other factors coming in, but this is then more maybe the signal processing part of this all. But again, I mean, you certainly know this when you're doing photography on your own, but if you have, like, if you have a very narrow field of view only, then you also have to take care that you still have enough light coming in into your camera, no? Onto your sensor. No? Of course, it's much easier to collect a lot of light when you have a shorter focal length here, so in practice, no? Then light comes from all different directions onto your sensor, while here it comes only from a very distant, narrow area. Okay, and why do you need a decent amount of light on the sensor? It's simple. Anyway, sorry, just checking. Okay, we need some signal. Okay, that's, I would say that's the minimum threshold. Let's say we are above the minimum threshold, so we get some signal. But still, why should we care? Yes, it's all about the signal to noise ratio. Yeah. So, and that depends on your photon statistics. So you would like to have enough light on the sensor to have a low, a reasonably low level of noise. Good. Yeah. So here's another thing to consider. And it's not very compatible with our statement, straight lines remain straight lines. this is radial distortion, and it's a lens effect. Yeah. So actually, we like to assume that we have no distortion in our imaging system, but practical imaging system, and particularly when we are thinking about zoom lenses, it happens to a great deal. Introduce a type of distortion that is either barrel distortion, so it goes, it looks as if it comes out, or pincushion distortion, which looks like squished into the image plane. Yeah, and straight lines are then accordingly appear bent, either towards the center or outside of the center. Of the scene, yeah. Like on natural scenes, you don't notice this, but if you, again, if you image man-made structures, buildings, with a lot of parallel lines, then you can observe this in the scene. So, I mean. Every one of you certainly has a smartphone or something. Did you observe barrel or pincushion distortion there?
I guess mostly not.
Okay, why might that be?
Yeah.
Yes, it's not a secret, no? that this barrel distortion or pincushion distortion happens. So the manufacturers in software then afterwards sort of undistort the image. Yeah? So it's part of the post-processing of an image. It's also it's not a smartphone feature actually. It happens in a lot of cameras. Like also in DSLR cameras. but if you, for example, if you are designing your own imaging system, then you are the vendor and you have to address this necessarily. Yeah? Or if you buy like the individual components without a firmware, like software firmware or so, then also you have to address this. Okay. Okay. Then, of course, I mentioned it already. We are not in the real world. We're not dealing with pinholes. We have apertures of finite sizes. So this gives us a limited depth of focus, of course, which may be desired for artistic purposes, such that, for example, only the blossom of the flower is in focus and the background is blurred. No? Or if you make the apertures very narrow, then like your depth of focus increases and you also get the background very sharp. Okay. Why is this? I already mentioned it earlier today, no? So if you have a small slit here, if you make the slit larger and larger, then by tendency you have more blur at the image plane. Yeah, but if you and in fact the depth of focus, so the slice of the world that is still in focus, becomes more and more narrow. Yeah. Okay. Nevertheless, it could be that all these optical effects are maybe a thing of the past or so. I don't know. If you look at modern smartphone cameras, they start to acquire a picture with a very high depth of focus. So everything is super sharp. And then they acquire a second picture with a depth camera and apply artificial blur. So an artificial impression of such a blur, which is not related to optics at all. Yeah. And I think we just have to see where the field moves to. Could be that in 10 years, like this slide is totally outdated and no one does it like that anymore. But let's say, okay, at least the past 100 years, it worked like this. No? Okay. Good. Yeah, here's a small fun application, and then I'm done for today. Here's a small fun application, which the authors called accidental cameras. So accidental pinhole and pinspec cameras revealing the scene outside the picture. This is a work by Toralba and Freeman, two very renowned computer vision people. So consider a room where the window is only a slit wide open. Yeah. And then it turns out that you sort of can use this as a huge pinhole to image the scene if like you do the actual data processing. So here's an example. So you take a reference image. You take a reference image where you are. So we take one image, one pinhole image, and one image without, and subtract both images, and we don't see much more. But it turns out that it's an upside down view of the scene on the opposite side of the road, yeah, which is somehow cool and a little bit like this, what they show in CSI, like, oh, zoom enhance, and so on. No? Still, we have a huge pinhole. I mean, we have a window-sized pinhole, yeah? So the image quality is, mediocre. But we can say, okay, there was maybe a building on the opposite side of the room or so. No, that might be a statement that you could do with such an accidental camera. So in a way, you're sort of leaking information if you have if you provide such images. Okay. Good. So last slide. Okay, so we talked about the vanishing points and lines. These are important aspects. So these are important geometric invariants. And then certainly the pinhole camera model. And what we will use most actually in the next few lectures is the camera projection matrix. So we have the intrinsic parameters collected in K and the extrinsic parameters split in rotation and translation of the camera. Okay, and all this is done in homogeneous coordinates. Okay, then thank you.